This is Bondi Tunes International, the week that was.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. How you doing? I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. And God knows how long I'm going to be in Bondi because we've got viruses everywhere. Rick Withby is our only New South Wales correspondent, and he joins me from Bibbinlook in rural New South Wales. Hey, Rick, what's going on? It's cold.
Well, mate, we've had a lot of bad weather, cold weather in this region, in the mountains here. Since the beginning of the year, really. I mean, we've got that really, really strong Indian Ocean dipole, and the La Nina effect is still very strong. So we've just been getting a lot of precipitation and wind.
Yeah.
And those old low pressure cells that form in the Southern Ocean have been coming through regularly.
And I would like to let our listeners know, in Europe and North America, yes, Australia does get cold. The parts of Australia do get cold. And it is damn cold in Sydney as well. It's pouring rain outside my window. And we've got wind. And I can hear, you know, you are from Britain. I'm from Ireland. We know about the cold, Rick. But, you know, you never get used to the heat, and suddenly it gets cold, and you think, oh my God, it brings, you know, Rick, it brings memories back to me of my childhood, of snow and all that sort of stuff. You never forget that, you know? Did you think
no,
that?
No, mate, you never forget it. We've had 6 inches of snow here a couple of times this year already. It settled and stayed around for a while. We get minus tens here, so I mean, it gets cold here. And when that wind starts ripping through from the Southern Ocean, it's easily as cold as. I've been cold, mate. You know, I mean, we've both been cold.
You've lived in various parts of the world where it's very hot and very cold.
Well, I did a lot of training with the military on Brecon Beacons, and that's famous for killing people, you know, from hypothermia, the Brecon Beacons. I've been cold, and you know, also we do a lot of cold water training in my branch of the military, just for the sheer hell of it, you know, up to your neck in 4 degree water for 8 hours. So you know, that's
oh my God.
I've been cold, but you know, it gets cold here. And now that I'm sort of approaching 70, the cold seems to have a far greater effect on me. In winter I live my life in thermals under a blanket.
Yeah, and I just want to explain to our listeners that Rick Withby is our correspondent in rural New South Wales, and he was Army Physical Training Corps and Royal Army Medical Corps. You have seen it all, haven't you?
Yeah, mate, I've had a very, very eclectic life, you know. Yes, I have.
And do you say you're approaching 70. Are you 69? Is it that close?
No, it's not that close.
Okay. But,
you know, I mean, 67 is close enough for me, you know. I mean, aging is not incremental, slow increments. It tends to suddenly creep up on you. You know,
yeah.
Day you're fine, and then the next stage of aging kicks in overnight.
I know. It's, you know, time actually moves faster as you get older. I'm just trying to think of her name, Maggie Smith, the actor. Maggie Smith.
Yeah.
She was doing an interview on 60 Minutes in America, and she said, you know, when you have 3 breakfasts in one day, you know you're getting old. And she's like turning 80. And I thought, what does she mean by 3 breakfasts in one day? And then it clicked. She actually meant that time is moving so fast as you get older that she feels like she's had 3 days in one day. And it's true. Time moves faster.
Of course, it's actually a mathematical algorithm. And it's a very simple one if you think about it. But they've studied this. If you look at when you're 10 years old,
Yes.
Okay. Then 1 year is just a tenth of the life you've lived. So a year seems like a long time. Experientially, a year seems a long time. Now let's say for ease of mental arithmetic, let's say you're 100-year-old. A year is only 1/100th of your life, so it passes by quicker. And that's a mathematical equation, and it's a lot deeper than that. But that's it in simple form. I always say, life is like a toilet roll. The older you get, the closer to the end you get on a toilet roll, the faster it rolls off.
A really good analogy. I love that.
Yeah, well, it's true, isn't it?
Well, you know, I'm. Where are we now? As we record, it's the 20th of June. I'm turning 59 on July 2nd, and I find this disturbing. I really do. It's really funny because up to the age of about 55, I didn't think about my age at all, and then I thought, oh shit, like it's now I'm 56 and now I'm 57, and it does play on my mind, because I wake up in the morning, and God knows I don't sleep any better than you, Rick. I wake up in the morning,
especially in the summer.
Oh yes, when it's like 23 degrees in the middle of the night, I wake up and I think, you know, I do daily now actually wake up and think, oh my God, I'm 58. It's like I've suddenly had this wall hitting me called death. I mean, does that disturb you at all?
No. I'm quite looking forward to the peace and quiet of it all, mate.
Well, do you believe in God?
No, absolutely not. God is an imaginary friend for those who are weak of mind, I'm afraid.
Yes, I agree with you, and many wouldn't, but I believe...
I don't care.
But, you know, Rick...
agree with me or not.
Rick, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people, I think, you know, if we talk about, you know, the scriptures and the Bible, and the Bible, you know... I did about 12 years ago, I did a video documentary on... which was called Controlling the Masses, right? And the Bible was controlling the masses. It was just another form of media, if you like, or media. It was a medium to control the masses. And, you know, I think that people who believe in scriptures, and I'm not, you know, ridiculing them by any means, but the truth is, I think these people actually are afraid of dying.
Well, look, apart from the Abrahamic texts, you know, the Korah, the Quran,
yes,
and the Bible, which are basically just drivel, evil, nasty, horrible drivel as well. But quite apart from them, there are up to 3,000 other sky fairies out there, all of whom believe they're right. You know, and they're prepared to kill babies to prove that they're right.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of research done into the brain, and there are areas of the brain that are, you know, that are associated with religion and believing in religion, and those people who believe in sky fairies. Now, I will ridicule them because they kill babies, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And it's actually in the Bible as well, isn't it?
Oh, look... Anyway, back onto this part of the brain that they've discovered is associated with religiosity. It's found in some people and not in others. They can actually, you know, brain scan people and see this area of the brain being active. The interesting thing about that particular study that was done, and people will just say I'm being prejudiced here, yes I am. The interesting thing is that area of the brain is functionally underdeveloped. It is a part of the brain that exists in all human beings, obviously, but normally it matures. It's the area of fantasy and fairies and stuff that children have.
I was going to say it's like dream time.
In most people, well, I say most people, in a good section of the community, that area of the brain matures on, and we don't believe in Santa Claus, and we don't believe in the Tooth Fairy and anymore. But in religious people, that area of the brain is actually clinically been proven to be immature and underdeveloped. So, you know, that says it all to me.
It's really interesting you talk about that, because what you've done is you've actually talked scientifically about something that's emotional.
Well, yes, because science is everything. There's no science in the Bible, is there? There's no science. There is absolutely no science in religion. And if you get into that argument with a religious person, they'll just come back with the circular argument, oh, it's the mystery of, it's one of the mysteries of the universe. You know, it can't be proved. Well, you know, there you go. That says it all. You can't disprove the Easter Bunny either. Richard Dawkins pointed out, if I was to say I was religious and worshipped a teapot god, my god is a teapot god, and he exists out there in the universe, people would say, well, don't be ridiculous, where's the teapot? Oh, well, you can't see this teapot because it's orbiting the planet of Saturn, and it's so infinitesimally small that it can't be seen. There's always that circular argument that they come up with, and it's just ridiculous. And my bottom line for this, as always, as you know how I feel about these things, is
yes.
Religiosity is responsible for so much death and so much killing. Mm. Now, you could say that moderate religious people, and Richard Dawkins points this out in his book, The God Delusion, that the religious people, most religious people, are quite moderate, and they wouldn't dream of killing babies. They wouldn't dream of being extremists and planting bombs and doing whatever you do. And it's not just the Muslim religion that does it. They all do it.
Yes, of
including
course.
Christians.
That's a very important thing to say. It's across all religions.
Yeah, well, our bombs have been dropped in Yemen as we speak. Mm. Australian bombs. But what Richard Dawkins points out is that religiosity and religion is a pyramidal structure. You've got the top of that, which is complete and overbearing belief, and then down at the bottom of the pyramid you've got the moderate people. Mm. and at the top, as I say, you've got the extremists who really, really, now, like any pyramid, and he points this out, the base of the pyramid provides succor and support for the tip of the pyramid. So you've got all these people who think they're moderate, but in actual fact what they're doing is they are providing a support base for these evil buggers up there that would see religion and extreme religious views thrust upon us all. Mm. And forget, democracy's dead as we speak, but it ever reestablishing itself.
Yeah,
look at our Prime Minister. Look at him.
The Australian Prime Minister, yes.
Scott he talks Morrison. In tongues.
Well, he's part of that weird church, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, a church that was formed by a pedophile.
Yeah, we've talked about this so many times.
You know.
Look, Rick, and if you've just joined us, I'm talking with Rick with a PR correspondent in rural New South Wales, Bibb and Luke. It's a beautiful town. I think there's about five people in there. And Rick, you know, I want to talk about Israel because I've interviewed our Israeli correspondent recently, and he's in Tel Aviv, and there's a lot of stuff going on with Netanyahu, who is the ousted prime minister. Now, I know you're a worldly kind of guy, so you might know a little bit about this. I lived in Israel for a year, and that was a troublesome year. It was 1983, when I was a very young man, and they were fighting with Lebanon. Do you think countries like Israel will ever be at peace?
Do I think the Middle East will ever be at peace?
Well, I was going to say countries like Israel.
No, I don't, because the Abrahamic religions are going to continue warring. And it's like Northern Ireland. George Bernard Shaw once said, it's just like Northern Ireland. As soon as somebody finds the answer to the Irish question, An Irish, an Irishman will change the question.
Yes.
Now, and that that is the same in the Middle East. As soon as somebody finds an answer to the problem in the Middle East, a person, you know, somebody from the Middle East will change the question.
Is, you know? What is at the basis of that, Rick? Is it the need for conflict? We talked about the brain earlier on. Is there a need for conflict in the brain of some people? As a human race, so you've got two whippets there, and they're beautiful animals. I've got a cat who never wants war. I wonder why humans want war. I don't understand it. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting in itself, because you would have heard of the chimpanzee. You would have heard of chimpanzees.
Yes.
Obviously, you've heard of chimpanzees. Well, basically, there are two substructures of chimpanzees. You've got the bonobo chimps, and I'm having a seniors moment. There is another subspecies of chimpanzee. Now, the interesting thing about those two different subspecies of chimpanzees, and anybody who knows anything about animals, in particular apes, would tell you that these two, they have different ways of solving their issues.
Mm.
Now, one group of these chimpanzees, they're quite a larger, they're a larger subspecies, and they are very, very aggressive and very, very warlike. They go around in gangs, tromping through the jungle. I think it's the Congo, and they tromp through. And if they come across any other chimpanzees in their area or what is deemed to be their patch, they will kill. They will go to war, and they will absolutely kill. And they go in, and when I say kill, they don't just kill. They go in and destroy everything, and they even kill all the babies by bashing their heads against trees and then eating the babies.
Good Lord.
Yeah, this is the very, very aggressive subspecies. You could Google it. You could Google it.
Yeah.
Very, very aggressive.
Yeah,
subspecies.
And our listeners probably are Googling it.
But the other subspecies, interestingly enough, and it's quite funny to watch them, whenever they have conflict within the group or within any part of any different tribes of that subspecies, if you like, they solve their problems by...
I can't put that on the air.
Well, that's what
they... It's okay,
I'll
put a beep out. No, but it's interesting. Do you relate, you know, the chimpanzees to humans in terms of the fact that there are humans who are naturally aggressive as well?
Yes, I do. They're our closest living relative in the great apes. And yes, I do. I think that it's like religion. There are those people that that are pacifist, which would include me, which is paradoxical considering my military career.
I was going to say that this is paradoxical because you have worked in the army most of your life, and it's all about killing, isn't it?
Well, no, because I was a bit of a Hacksaw Ridge bloke. I was a combat medic, and I intentionally joined the Royal Army Medical Corps for that reason. I needed to desperately to get away from the unemployment and terrible culture terrible society that the north of Britain was in the early 70s,
yes,
the late
yes.
60s, early 70s. There was no work, and I needed work. So,
and, you know, we've talked about this many times, and also your family life was not exactly, you know...
God, you remember. Yeah, my father was a brute. So I needed to get away. So joining the army was a way I could do that. The RAF wouldn't take me.
Why?
Because they're very picky.
I guess it
no,
would be.
I wanted to be my career in the RAF. I wanted to be an aircraft engineer, but they do a lot of psychometric testing on you, and I wasn't. I was too thick.
Oh, come on! You don't sound thick to me. But,
no, look, I didn't have the necessary mathematical skills.
But
my areas. My areas of intelligence lie in other directions.
Yeah, but the thing is, it obviously did, because the job you did as a medic was pretty difficult, I would say.
Oh, it could have been. There were some fun times as well, you know. I mean, serving in West Germany during the Cold War was just one long drunken haze, I think. But
really?
Oh God, yeah, yeah.
What were the girls like?
If the Russian bear had decided to come across that border, mate, if he'd done it on a Saturday night, we'd have invited him in for a drink. Never mind defending the free world. We were all drunk.
If you talk about war, and particularly the First World War, I think there was a case in France where at Christmas they sort of put down their arms and they all shook hands and had a drink. I'm talking about the First World War here. And I find that interesting because they really were just puppets for governments of the world, Rick.
They still are. Yeah. That's what governments do to soldiers. It's like what's happened in Northern Ireland. You knew all about the troubles,
course,
and,
yes, the troubles.
And now the soldiers that served in the troubles are being hunted down like dogs. They're hunting down Australians. So the start of the hunt for Australian soldiers now. It's break 'em around all over again. Well, they train you. They recruit you. They train you to be a killer. They send you. You kill somebody. You come back. They look for a scapegoat. You know, it's gone throughout history.
Is there a sense of brainwashing with young? You know, as someone who has not been in an army and has not gone to war, I find that in the domestic world, if you employ someone, you're going to employ a young person so you can infiltrate their brain. And it is kind of the same kind of psychological brainwashing that goes on.
It isn't kind of, it exactly is. The first 12 weeks of any military training program, and don't forget, as a military trainer of the highest order, I was one of a very select group of military trainers in the final years of my career in the British Army. I was in the, as you know, in the very, very exclusive Royal Army Physical Training Corps, and that was our job. And it was, the first 12 weeks of any recruit training is completely about brainwashing. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
You've seen
Full Metal Jacket. Well, that's exactly what it's like.
Yeah, and I think that was true to its form. That
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely true.
What is segregation?
I don't know what segregation is.
What is bigotry?
I don't know what bigotry is.
What does hatred mean?
I don't know what it is.
What is prejudice?
I think it's when somebody's sick.
Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, seeing the fellow, and it looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin. Dallas, Texas. The flash, apparently official. President John F. Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Anybody here see my old friend Martin? Can you tell me where he's gone? He's freed a lot of people, but it seems so good they die young.
That's a cold days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live.
No one can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed.
Yordi has just sent me a message that we've been here too long already. So, my thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. Rayford Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot. Get the gun. Stay away from the gun.
His hand is frozen. Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. All right. That's it, Rayford. Get it. Get the gun, Rayford. Hold him. We don't want another Oswald.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty. That is the way he lived. That is what he leaves us. My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today, pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times, in many parts of this nation, those he touched and who sought to touch him. Some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
What is segregation?
I don't know what segregation is.
What is bigotry?
I don't know what bigotry is.
What does hatred mean?
I don't know what it is.
What is prejudice?
I think it's when somebody's sick.
Do you think that as someone who's, you know, nearly 70, do you think young men, and let's talk about Iraq and the situation in 1991 with George Bush, and then 2003 with George W. Bush going into Iraq, 2001 with the 9/11 situation, do you think that even to this day, that young people are being forced over? I'm interested in your point of view on the fact that we keep, in Australia, here where we are, we keep getting involved in wars, other people's wars. You know, why? Is it? Well, it used to be about oil, I thought.
Yeah, no, well, it's very easy to do. It's very easy to do when you're aligned with a naval empire like the United States, that regards itself as the world's policeman and the highest and having a high moral ground, which of course it doesn't, because it all around the world it kills people left, right, and centre, as do we. What governments do is they rely on, and they always have, and they always will, there is a natural nationalistic fervor in the young. They feel this really strong, they have a really, really strong feeling for nationalism and country. It's just a natural thing that you will find in young people. Mm. Plus, the government, every government throughout the world, resorts to jingoistic rhetoric that makes young people vulnerable because of their the feeling of nationalism and their want to be helping out, yeah, helping a country.
Yeah.
They're very, very easy to recruit because they use these jingoistic things and make it seem like it's a great act of self-sacrifice. So, you know, in the First World War, those poor men, they signed up and they ended up stuck in a slit trench in the Somme or trying to get onto the beach at Gallipoli in old iron lifeboats and getting shot at from hundreds of feet in the air with Maxim machine guns, you know, death from on high.
Yeah,
young men in particular, because of the testosterone and because of this nationalistic fervor that we all have, and even I have to a certain extent, are easy to recruit.
Yeah, if you just joined us, I'm talking with Rick Witherby, is our correspondent in Bibbulmun in rural New South Wales here in Australia. I want to talk about nationalism because, you know, I have got a lot of people attacking me by the fact or about the fact that I'm not a national. I don't believe. I'm from Ireland. You're from Britain. We both live in Australia, so we're perfectly examples of this. I don't believe in nationalism. I don't believe you. People say, are you proud to be Irish and when are you coming home and all this bullshit, and I'm going, no, I'm not nationalistic. And I hate the fact that America says, you know, we're great and we're the best country in the world. Nationalism is really a load of rubbish, isn't it?
I agree with you 100%. I've said it for years and years and years now, at least since I left the army, I would say that I've thought the same thing. As far as I'm concerned, it may sound trite, but I live on planet Earth.
Yeah.
And I owe no allegiance. I owe no allegiance to any country. I owe allegiance to my fellow man. And I, as you know, I spend a lot of time trying to help my fellow man. That's it. That's it.
And do you...
I don't care about being an Australian citizen, in as much as it gives me a place to live. That's all. If I have to have citizenship somewhere, then Australia or Britain, it doesn't really matter to me. I would not now go to war for this country, especially. When you look at this country at the moment, it bangs on about mateship, it bangs on about the Anzac spirit, but it's perfectly happy to leave tens of thousands of people stuck around the world, in particular India, to die, or potentially die, in the most squalid conditions, whilst we sit here in lockdown.
Pontificating about our nationalism, right?
Yeah, pontificating about how good we are and mateship and a fair go, yet there are 10,000 people as we speak with Australian passports that can't come home. They won't let them come home.
Yeah.
And they're putting on a couple of flights here and there just to appease
just
people
to keep
like you
everyone
and I.
Happy.
Just to appease. But there's still over 200 children over there with Australian that were born in Australia.
Yeah.
I said this to a bloke the other day, and he said to me, "Well, those people live in India, but they're claiming Australian pensions." And that's a load of crap because I'm a pensioner, and you can't claim your Australian pension overseas. If you go overseas, I lose it. So that's rubbish.
Yeah.
You know, there's only a certain amount of time. If you go overseas on an Australian pension, you have to inform the government that you're going overseas. Not that they wouldn't know anyway. Nowadays, with the interconnection and the surveillance we have these days,
they know everything.
They stop your pension. So this is an argument that is used by racist Australians. Which we are terribly.
Do you really feel that like us white Australians? Let's see. I just want to let our listeners know that you've been up to the Northern Territory twice or more, and also to Northwest Australia, and you've seen Aboriginal children with diseases that were biblical, like leprosy, and we don't talk about that. We started talking at 7:30 in the morning, and it's just after 8 in the morning here in Australia, and I was watching breakfast television, which is something I never do because I'm never awake this time in the morning normally, and I'm watching all this happy crap coming out of the ABC, which is the national broadcaster here, and there's no talk about what's going on in the Northern Territory. Tell me about your experiences. I know you have before, but we have new listeners, and I'd like you to tell me what you saw when you got your beautiful motorbike and went up to the Northern Territory and Northwest Australia.
Mate, what I saw was essentially is an apartheid Australia. That's what I saw. I mean, I saw, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I saw diseases that are third world diseases, like tuberculosis, like trachoma, syphilis, leprosy. All of these diseases are so easily cured in modern times. And we are the last developed nation on this planet to have trachoma. Children going blind with a couple of eye drops would be cured. Now, we live in an apartheid Australia. There's a big line drawn across the bottom half of northern Australia, particularly the Kimberley. And the Kimberley has the highest suicide rate in the world, and it's bigger than Great Britain. The conditions they live in up there are just rank. Absolutely rank.
Why is this so silent on the media?
Because the East Coast doesn't want to know. This is why my book, which I am now a published author.
Oh, yes, please tell us about that.
I am now a published author, and that book will be coming out in August, so not far away, that describes these things and describes the conditions I saw and talks about the people that I met. Up there, the wonderful, wonderful people that were so kind and caring to me and gave me stuff when they had nothing and gave me food, gave me water, gave me friendship when they had absolutely nothing and were living in third world conditions. And they get the blame for that, for God's sake.
Yeah,
we blame them.
And I just want to say hello to our listeners on Veterans Families Radio in the UK. They are very loyal to us, and we in return try to be loyal to them, because we talk about war and we talk about people who have who have been involved with war, and Veterans Families Radio is a fantastic radio station. Rick, tell me the name of this book and where people can get it.
Well, it's available through Birrily Press. Now, that's spelt B-I-R-L-I. So, Birrily, Bravo, India, Lima, Romeo, India, BirrilyPress.com. They and anybody who wanted to have a look at the synopsis for the text can go onto biraleepress.com and go onto and have a look at the synopsis, and there is a section called upcoming releases, and they can register their interest on there, and my publisher will get back to them. Now, it'll be published in hardback and also in ebook formats through Amazon, which whether or not, but the lesser of two evils, I guess.
Yes. what can you do? What can you do?
Well, I've got to get it out there, mate. I've got to let as many people know as possible about what's going on there. And the book itself, the name of the book is called Muriel the Medicycle. Which is a Muriel the Medicycle, and it's all about a little motorcycle ambulance that I took up into the far north and did a little bit of medical work and a little bit of hearts and minds activity in the far north because I saw that there was a need.
You know, Rick, you know, a lot of people on social media think you're a scary man. And well, you have the heart of gold, you really do. And you know, with this book, I don't think you're going to be interviewed by Channel 9, 7, 10 anytime soon, are you?
No, I won't. No.
What about the ABC, the national broadcaster in Australia? Will they?
Look, every major organisation that I came across, with the exception of the local newspaper published an article that I couldn't believe. They published it verbatim about what I saw up there, and I was quite surprised at that. But I got told, as I've told you before, by many media...
shut the hell up.
Yeah, we don't want to hear about this. If you're going to talk to us about your journey, then talk about the journey. But don't talk to us about what you saw in terms of first Australians and the disenfranchisement, the disease, the deprivation, and you know, I call it the four D's of Aboriginal Australia.
You mentioned earlier on this horrid word called apartheid, or apartheid, which I, as a newsreader back in the 80s, had to report with South Africa. And I just wonder, you know, it's like a kind of veiled apartheid, isn't it? Because
it's not veiled up there. I went to a horse race.
I'm talking about the media here. You know, it's veiled
the media,
by the media.
Yeah, they veil it, yeah. But it's apartheid's not veiled up there, you know. I mean, the black fellas in the communities I were in were not allowed to go anywhere near a lot of white fella functions. It was just tacit exclusion. They knew wouldn't be welcome. They knew they would be thrown out, so they didn't go.
I went to Alice Springs about 11 years ago, and it is an alcohol-free zone, if you like, except if you're white, like me. And they had these kind of conclaves of bars and this kind of thing, but the black fellas weren't allowed in. Is there a real problem with alcohol and Aboriginals, or is this a media hype?
The media hype it up. It's no worse than where you live.
So it's okay here in Bondi in Sydney for me to go into a bar and get shit faced, and you know, but it's not okay for them.
And go around the streets and keep you awake till 4 o'clock in the morning, screaming and shouting.
And they do, and you know they do because I scream.
Yeah, exactly. It's all well and good, but you know when I'm standing in a remote community in the far north, with one beer in my hand, talking to a group of black fellas, and the police scream up in a paddy wagon and threaten to arrest me if I don't put my can of beer down. And what are you doing drinking beer? And I said, well, it's 45 degrees.
Is this because you're with black fellas?
And You know, one night I was sat by a campfire with another 70-year-old man, and we were having a beer, and a police paddy wagon screams across the bushland, screaming across in a great cloud of dust in the middle of bloody nowhere, comes to a screeching halt in front of our little campfire that we had going, the two of us, two old men.
Who was the other guy?
Oh, he was an elder that I was having a
chat
with.
So he was an Aboriginal elder?
Yeah.
And you got...
And the cop just leans out the window and abuses us and tells us not to get up to any mischief. And this guy was so afraid.
And he's a spiritual man, I'm sure. He's an elder.
Very well. And he was so afraid, I didn't say anything, but I felt like saying something. And then he takes off, turns his light bar on, so we're flooded in brilliant LED light.
This is horrific.
And he takes off in a cloud of dust. I got... The only people I needed to be afraid of in the top end were white fellas and police.
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah, well... Yeah, you talk about me being an angry man and people being afraid of me. Well, you know, there's good reason.
Yeah, but it's just the stories you tell us here on Bondi Tunes International is that Australia is not what people see in places like Britain and America, and we put these nice, happy sort of TVCs or television commercials with happy, and they even, you know, to just rub salt into the wound, they put Aboriginals on these television commercials to come to Australia. And the irony, Rick, the irony, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's the token black fella that they put on. In everything they do these days, there's a token. Even Ken Wyatt, you know, the Aboriginal minister, he's kept quiet. You know, he's a token minister. He's got no power. Nothing ever happens. He never did anything in WA for his people. They don't like him. You know, I spoke one of the elders I spoke with, Reginald Birch, Order of Australia Medal, who was an Australian envoy to the United Nations until recently. He rocked the boat a little bit too much and the system ruined him. He lives in squalor.
Gosh. This is horrific stuff, and I've kept you so long, Rick. I'm so sorry. How are the Whippets? Are they going okay there, or are they going,
yeah,
where's my breakfast?
Yeah, One, the older one has decided she's got my lap and she's underneath the blanket on my lap. And I have a nice electric blanket underneath the chair because heating a house up here, my big house, is ridiculously expensive. So I don't. I don't heat the house, I heat myself.
Oh.
And the other one has decided that he's been ostracized and he's found another spot in another chair under a blanket on the other chair. So,
aren't animals so much nicer than humans?
Absolutely.
I've got a cat here.
So
I've got a cat here that annoys the hell out of me, but I love this cat. Just before you go, I just want to ask you, if you were 17 years old now in the year 2021, would you go into the army?
No.
What would you do? Because your circumstances were quite unique.
I would look at some sort of humanitarian work. I always wanted to be a doctor. I would have, knowing what I know now, I would have proceeded with my my ambitions to become a doctor.
Hmm.
That's what I would do now. And because, as you point out, a lot of people that you probably know think I'm a scary man. Well, I'm the product.
Well, you know,
I am the product of a paradigm that is so damn hypocritical.
Yeah, and I want to preface this, but you know, you are a scary man to a lot of people who are sitting in the cotton wool world of media.
Yeah.
I keep talking about media because media affects everyone, even the 14-year-old who's on their smartphone is being affected by this really, in my view, pretty nasty media that you know, doesn't expose anything. When I say that, you know, you're a scary man, it's only because you're a realist, and I'm a realist, and I'm a scary man. A lot of people don't like me on social media, I got to tell you. You know,
you're probably one of the few media groups that is prepared to allow me to vent my disdain for the absolute hypocrisy that goes on, but in particular in Australia, it's absolute hypocrisy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
A fair go, Anzac spirit. I did my last Anzac Day this year. I won't be doing it again. Not after they left all of those people in India.
Yeah, and this is interesting. Anzac, of course, Australia, New Zealand, First World War, Gallipoli, just to let our listeners know, in Europe, it has been something where people would actually go to Gallipoli, and apparently, Rick, you know, a lot of people would go to Gallipoli and just get pissed, get drunk, and they didn't even care about what was going on at these anniversaries, you know.
What's interesting is there were 8,000 casualties at Gallipoli.
Mm.
8,000.
Yeah.
There were 22,000 British casualties at Gallipoli, and interestingly enough, there were 5,000 Indian soldiers casualties at Gallipoli. 5,000.
Wow.
And the Australian soldiers and the Indian soldiers loved each other. They got on so well. I've read about this. How well they got on together. You never hear any mention of the Indian soldiers as part of the Anzac forces that landed at Gallipoli.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Well, there you go. 5,000.
Gosh.
Indian casualties. And what are we doing now? We're leaving any Indian Australians to rot in India, and presumably, this hasn't been covered, but there's a lot of things not being talked about at the moment.
Absolutely right.
They're probably being burnt on those awful bloody funeral pyres in car parks.
Yes, yes. It's horrific, isn't it? And, you know, that we saw that footage on mainstream media of the pyres, and they had to actually dig bones out of previous dead bodies out of the pyres to put other bodies in. The situation is horrific. It got 5 seconds of airtime on commercial television and commercial media, and now it's still happening, but we're not seeing it anymore. That's how the media works.
All of those things.
Yeah.
Also, another thing that we're not seeing is what's going on in Britain. It has not been publicised in the media. Despite all the vaccination in Britain, and they're very, very close to 100% vaccination in Britain, the virus, they're in lockdown again. So this vaccine is not the way out of lockdown. It is not the way out of this police state that we live in.
I agree.
And have you heard that? I have noticed a complete absence of that fact being publicised on Australian media. The other thing is what they're doing in Britain, and I have this on good authority. I'm not going to say an expert, because experts are an ex is a has-been and a spurt is a drip under pressure. that the figures in Britain are being fudged at the moment. Any COVID cases that are regarded as minor nowadays are not being reported as COVID cases. It's been actively discouraged by the medical profession to report numbers on minor cases of COVID.
It's all bullshit, isn't it? It's media,
you know, and
bullshit.
And people who are dying from COVID, they're not actually dying from COVID, mate. They're dying from pre-existing conditions like heart disease and diabetes and emphysema and stuff like that. That's what's killing them.
Yeah.
The COVID is just it tips them over the edge. But now these figures are being fudged to make it look like these vaccines are going to bring us all out of lockdown, but they're not. Britain's in lockdown.
Are you getting a vaccine?
No way.
Neither am I.
No way.
Neither am I. And
I'm told I'm selfish because I won't do it. Well, I'm not a selfish person, you know that.
Yeah.
But I am not going to take the thought bubble. It's a thought bubble. They've come up with it. It's full of holes.
Yeah.
They didn't tell us that it would create. They keep changing the parameters around strokes and around blood clots. They keep changing those things.
Yeah.
Now it's up to 60. I guess after 60, it doesn't matter if you get a blood clot. But, you know, and what they don't tell you is, they say, oh, one in 1 million or one in whatever ridiculous figure dies from a stroke. Related, don't worry about it, only one in 1 million. Have you ever seen what happens if you have a stroke and don't, Danny?
Oh, that's a good point.
You
a very
are fucked
good
up,
point.
And there's quite a few of them.
Yeah.
There's quite a few of them. Why would I, who lives in the snowy mountains and I have a zero risk of encountering or even catching COVID, why would I increase my risk by any degree by taking a vaccine?
As you may know, I've talked on social media a lot about this. You know, they say only one in a million with AstraZeneca vaccine.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, you know, that's not good enough for me. I don't want to be one in a million, you know.
Well, being struck by lightning or being in an aeroplane that crashes are very, very rare events as well.
Yes.
Unless you're sitting in that aeroplane.
But why?
Then it's not rare.
Why would I do that? Like, well, you know, 100% is 100%. 99% is not good enough for my body. It's not good enough for my being on this planet.
The other issue is this is an attenuated vaccine. Attenuated vaccines. Look at the outbreak of polio in Papua New Guinea at the moment. It's gone off.
Yeah.
And it came from the vaccine.
Is that right? I did not know
that. Absolutely, yeah. Thousands of people across Papua New Guinea.
Why is no one talking about that? that's important.
The vaccine that they used was an attenuated vaccine. And it got into the sewage system and it mutated. And it got back into people. And it mutated again. And then the people who got the vaccine developed polio, because the vaccine itself was so similar to the real thing, and there's been an explosion of polio in Papua New Guinea due to the vaccine, because we excrete vaccines, attenuated vaccines, we excrete portions
it is,
of
but
them.
Rick, is this a fact?
Absolute fact. Look it up.
Why is no one talking about this?
Because it goes against the norm. You can Google it. Go polio outbreak in Papua New Guinea. It will tell you all about it. It's because of the vaccine.
Okay.
You know that they look for these viruses in our poop. They go to sewage farms and they can tell if there's a virus in our poo, can't they?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Well, that virus got into the sewage system. The polio virus got into the system, into the sewage systems, of Papua New Guinea, and worked its way back into the community via the oral vector, and people started getting polio again, despite the vaccine, and the vaccine did them no good.
And you do not see that on Channel 9 News.
No. It was on the actual. To be fair, the ABC had a half-an-hour program on it just recently on an ill-considered vaccine that mutated within the human body and within the fecal matter of the human into something that was more dangerous.
Okay. We got to go. Rick Witherpee, you are a wealth of information and wisdom, and I really appreciate when you come on our airwaves. Thank you so much.
I listen, and if you want proof of that, if you want absolute proof, Google it.
Okay, just Google it.
Polio outbreak, vaccine, polio outbreak, all the keywords, Papua New Guinea, you'll be all over it.
Okay, thank you so much, Rick. This is Bondi Tunes International, this is Real Radio.
Thank you. Henry O'Donovan.